late at night, on April 13th, Iran began its attack. ...170 drones, 120 ballistic missiles, and 30 cruise missiles were fired at Israel. The projectiles did not reach their targets until the early hours of April 14th, by which time the vast majority had been shot down. Western outrage followed. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen made a statement the morning after the attack.
Yesterday, Iran launched a massive attack against Israel using drones and missiles. Such a direct Iranian attack against Israel is unprecedented. Today, we, the leaders of the G7, condemned this in the strongest terms. We expressed our solidarity and support to the people of Israel and reaffirmed our unshakable commitment towards its security.
Given the nature and scale of the attack, it was almost guaranteed that Israel would respond. Amid intense speculation, news that Israel had retaliated broke in the early hours of Friday, April 19th. Just as what followed Iran's attack, following Israel's retaliation, Global Voices called for calm. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke to reporters.
We're committed to Israel's security. We're also committed to de-escalating, to bring this tension to a close.
This week, why did Iran attack, and what did it hope to achieve? Has Israel's muted retaliation reduced the risk of further Iranian attacks? And has the region avoided a catastrophic regional conflict, or is the threat still present? My name is Hugo Goodridge, and you're listening to The New Arab Voice. Iran launched its attack on April 14th, but the story starts a couple of weeks earlier. On April 1st, Israel attacked the Iranian consulate building in the Syrian capital Damascus. The strike killed Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, among other senior commanders. To attack another nation's embassy is a violation of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. To attack an embassy is to effectively attack a nation's home soil. This made the Israeli consulate attack of April 1st substantively different to the countless other Israeli attacks that targeted Iranian interests and personnel in Syria in the past. 2 days later, on April 3rd, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi promised that Iran would respond.
The violation of all humanitarian principles and international laws, including the terrorist attack of this regime, Israel, on the consulate of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Damascus, although it will not go unanswered, shows the height of frustration and helplessness of this regime. Trust in God, the usurping Zionist regime will be punished by the brave men on the front and resistance groups. They will regret this crime and similar ones.
Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei was more colloquial, telling a crowd that Israel would be, quote, slapped for that action. Perhaps smelling smoke from a tinderbox, Western leaders urged calm and restraint. A spokesperson for the European Union spoke with reporters on April 2nd.
We are alarmed by the alleged Israeli strike on an Iranian diplomatic building in the Syrian capital in Damascus and the targeting of a consulate, actually, which is a diplomatic facility. And our position is that in this highly tense regional situation, it is really of an utmost importance to show restraint, because the further escalation in the region is in no one's interests.
But as we know, and as was expected, Iran did respond.
Iran changed the rules of engagement with this direct attack against Israel. It said that this was in retaliation to the Israeli attack and the assassination, essentially, of 7 military commanders at their consulate in Damascus.
This is Marissa Kerma, director of the Middle East program at the Wilson Center.
For them, this completely crossed the line, and their personnel, particularly members of the Revolutionary Guard, are sacred. And they escalated further with this direct attack, raising tensions across the region.
A like-for-like attack would be an attack that targets the Israeli interior, which is exactly what they did.
When we go back to that evening, I have to admit, first of all, that I was surprised. I did not think that we're going to do anything on this scale.
This is Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute and author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy.
And then later on, seeing how much of a heads up they gave to the Israelis, it started to look really as if this is just for show. This is simply performative.
It was a significant heads up. This was not a surprise attack. It was telegraphed and advertised by the Iranians. They informed the parties, not directly, but through intermediaries, of their intention to attack, and the time and date of when that attack would happen. Some reports have claimed that Iran gave 72 hours advanced warning of the attack. With such a warning, Israel and its allies and other regional governments were able to prepare the necessary defences. Subsequently, of the 300-odd projectiles that were fired by Iran, only a small handful made their way through. Marissa Kerma again.
It's hard to know if Iran was aware that there will be such a high interception rate, but they are also rational actors in the way that they study their military plans and the region. And they're aware that the United States is not just a key strategic ally to Israel, but has said multiple times that when it comes to Israel's defense, this support is ironclad, right? So I think that they are very much aware that the United States was going to ensure the security of Israel because it does lie under its umbrella and it is the number one provider of military assistance to Israel. So I think knowing that in the background, there was some understanding that some interception would have taken place. But how much of that was predicted in terms of the percentage, I think it's hard to know what they had in mind.
The defense of Israel was supported by the US, UK, France, and Jordan, who all played a role in shooting down the Iranian projectiles. The interception is estimated to have cost in excess of $1 billion. And given the warning that they had, this raises an important and worrying question. Trita Parsi again.
But the question then now comes up is, how successful would they have been had the Iranians not given them 72 hours of a heads up, which then would have enabled the United States, it enabled the United States to prepare and be part of this. In the absence of that heads up, the U.S. role would have been very limited, as well as the role of the others. How would Israel have performed then?
Iran's attack was vast, but given the warning that they gave, it certainly doesn't appear that mass casualties or devastation was their intention. So what did they want?
Israel was, for quite some time, changing the rules of engagement that would define the conflict between the sides for years, especially in Syria, by shifting from basically targeting the bases and convoys belonging to Iran to targeting high-ranking military officials and, in the most recent case, an Iranian diplomatic compound in which military commanders actually were also present.
This is Hamid Reza Azizi, visiting fellow at the German Institute for International Security Affairs in Berlin.
So Iran wanted to make sure that, it's not going to happen. I mean, to make sure that the other party, basically, will get the message that it's not going to happen, and also to prevent further incidents like that, because the prevailing view in Tehran was that, this kind of pattern of Israeli strikes have been changing for some time, and if we do not react at this moment, then the next move for them might be to go for an overt attack inside our territory. And this is something we need to prevent.
In short, it was a message to Israel. You've gone too far. The attack of April 1st changed the rules of the game. And now Iran felt compelled to set a new equilibrium. They had to respond. Trita Parsi.
So it seems like the Iranians managed, perhaps there was some luck in it as well, but they managed to show they can hit Israel. And they can hit Israel in such a way that it actually penetrates Israel's air defenses. And this is a big difference then, because it reveals that the maneuverability and the freedom of action that Israel enjoyed before, in which it essentially could whack any country in the region with impunity, that has now come to an end. That's not to say that Iran is stronger than Israel or that Iran would win a war against Israel. I don't think it likely would. But Israel can also no longer strike at Iran without expecting to pay a high price. And that price is such that it actually can bring about significant damage to very sensitive installations inside of Israel.
The attack by Iran on April 14th said that Iran was prepared to use military force. But simultaneously, they also sought to avert war and calm tensions. In one Orwellian expression, they wanted to escalate to de-escalate. Hamid Reza Azizi.
So it was quite obvious that they wanted to do something, and they wanted to do something significant, but at the same time, they didn't want a war. And that's kind of a level of preparedness on the side of Israel and its allies. And basically, that prior warning contributed a lot to, you know, the situation not escalating further. But at the same time, the Iranians, as it was obvious in their statements, they made it clear that they want a new equation.
The one thing that they did not use was the element of surprise. That would have been a completely different scenario, because then we would have seen a lot more damage, possibly civilian casualties, and it would have changed the calculus across the region in a very different way.
For all the 300-odd drones and missiles that were fired, the damage was limited. The Nevatin airbase and Ramon airbase towards the south of the country were confirmed to have been hit, but Israel claims that the damage was not substantial. Iran claimed to have hit bases in the Golan Heights in the north, but these have not been confirmed. The lack of any crippling blow to Israel's military infrastructure, combined with the advanced warning of the attack, point to an Iranian desire not to escalate, while also show strength. Can we say that the Iranians were successful in their aims?
I mean, in their own view, it seems that they are quite satisfied with the results of the attack. If we refer to, for example, Khamenei's remarks in his meeting with top-ranking military commanders on April 21, he kind of praised what the armed forces did.
During recent events, the armed forces showed a good image of their abilities and power. They also proved the emergence of the power of the Iranian nation's determination at the international level.
From that, we can conclude that, at least at this stage, especially given the limited scope of the Israeli response, they think that they have at least been successful in sending their message. But
Khamenei had more to say.
The issue with the number of missiles fired or the missiles that hit the target on the other side is a secondary issue. The main issue is the emergence of the willpower of the Iranian nation and the armed forces in the international arena.
By Iran's estimates, the message was sent. As to whether or not Israel read and understood the message, time will tell. Iran's attack can also be viewed as an exercise in information gathering or reconnaissance by fire.
There's two ways of looking at this. On the one hand, you can look at it and say, well, look, clearly the Israelis likely would not have been able to perform as well without all of this additional help from other countries, and particularly the support of the United States. On the other hand, you can say, no, What happened here is that by the US and the Brits and others participating in this, it deprived the Iranians with fuller knowledge of what Israel's air defenses are capable of. So it did not manage to get the exact or more exact information of what it's capable of. So Israel still managed to keep its cards close to the chest rather than revealing them. I think the counter argument to that is, well, even in that scenario, if seven ballistic missiles went through and managed to hit Israeli bases, that nevertheless reveals quite a lot about Israel's air defenses. Perhaps they would have been able to do better without the US's help, but I very much doubt that.
As mentioned, the vast majority of these drones were shot down before they ever reached their targets. Obviously, Israel shot down plenty. The US too played a significant role. The UK and France also stepped in to defend Israel. These all make sense, but so too did Jordan, which perhaps makes less sense. Why is an Arab nation stepping up to defend Israel at a time when Israel is committing genocide in Gaza and whose actions have fostered intense outrage among the Jordanian population?
And for them, that was a violation of their airspace. And the Jordanian government was very clear, you know, a few days after the April 13th attack, that they would do the same if Israel would also try to use their airspace for a retaliatory attack against Iran. I think that was part of their effort to balance what they've done and try to communicate, well, to communicate why they took that step to basically shoot down these drones. I mean, some of the droplings of these drones were found in civilian centers in Amman. So I think for a lot of Jordanians that evening, there was a sense of uncertainty and fear, and it became very real.
It's worth noting that Jordan and Iran aren't strictly friends. They're not enemies, but the war in Syria, which Iran has been heavily involved in, has caused numerous problems for Jordan. In recent years, it's particularly the Iranian-enabled drug smuggling routes that cross from Syria and into Jordan.
So Jordan is constantly trying to balance its position, but it's also very clear. And, you know, the king came out and said that we will take whatever measures necessary to protect our territory. This is about territorial integrity. This is about our sovereignty and about protecting our people. There's tremendous support, unquestionable support, and very understandable for the Palestinian cause in Jordan and across the Arab world. And with Jordan in particular, A, it hosts the largest number of Palestinian refugees, and many families in Jordan are also of Palestinian descent. And for many Jordanians, they've lost family, they've lost property, they've lost friends. So this is very deeply felt in Jordan. I think that if you look at sort of the social media landscape after this Iranian attack, there were many that were extremely critical of what Jordan did in terms of basically shooting down some of these drones. And that's when, you know, the foreign minister and other government officials also went out and talked about this. The king himself also reiterated the need to protect Jordan's territory, sovereignty, and its people.
Following the shooting down of the Iranian projectiles, the Jordanian authorities quickly sought to compartmentalize the Iranian attack and Jordan's response, and the ongoing war in Gaza. For them, two issues, with two separate responses. The Jordanian Minister of Foreign Affairs, Ayman Safadi, addressed reporters on April 16th.
We will not become a theatre of war for any regional conflict and will not allow anyone to expose the security of Jordan and the safety of its people to any risk. This is a clear message that we're sending to everyone, to Israel and Iran, that we will not allow you to turn Jordan into a theatre of war.
Following the Iranian attack, Israel vowed a response, despite calls for restraint. In the early hours of Friday, April 19th, Israel followed up on their promise. Their attack targeted the central Iranian province of Isfahan, with additional strikes hitting targets in Syria and Iraq. Iran's uranium conversion facility and enrichment facilities are both located in Isfahan province. Additionally, it's the site of a number of important military bases. Another interesting point to Israel's attack is that it would appear that they listened to Jordanian warnings about using their airspace and flew around, instead going through Syria and Iraq. And the intention behind this attack appears to be similar to that of Iran's.
On one side, the Israelis wanted to make it clear that they also don't want war, because, you know, there could be 100 different scenarios through which they could ignite a war if they wanted. But at the same time, they wanted to also make it clear that they don't accept these so-called new equations by the Iranians. And they are going to stick to their policy of so-called campaign between the wars, targeting Iran, and they won't shy away from basically even targeting some places within Iran if push comes to shove.
The Israelis' choice of target was significant.
That's where lies the significance of the attack, because it wasn't just anywhere where the Israelis targeted. It was Isfahan is located right in the heart of the country. So on one side, Israel wanted to show its access basically all over the Iranian territory. And it was quite close to some of Iran's nuclear and military facilities. And based on the reports that we have, what they actually targeted was the radar system of one of the S-300 air defenses that Iran has established there. So I think the message by the Israelis was also quite strong, that we do have the capability to strike back, so let's just stick to the prior rules of engagement.
Similar to Iran's strike on Israel, damage caused by the Israeli attack was minimal, and certainly minimal enough for the Iranian regime to almost ignore the attack. After the attack, officials claimed that no damage was caused. And just like with the Iranians, amidst all the loud bangs and bright lights, there was an odd message of de-escalation. Although we can't be sure from where this message came from, the Israelis or the Americans.
No, I think the U.S. pressure and, you know, more broadly speaking, the pressure of Israel's Western allies was quite significant in basically defining and determining the scope of Israel's response. Because if we refer to the media reports, for example, different outlets published in the days after the Israeli attack, they were already considering quite a few options, you know, ranging from a widespread attack within Iran to some sort of lower scale responses like they did, like what they did in Isfahan. So I think from the very first moments after the Iranian attack, the United States was quite clear that Israel should act based on self-restraint, and that Washington doesn't want, a regional war. So did Israel's other allies.
I think without a doubt, the U.S., as well as to some extent the Europeans, played a role in holding Israel back. But it was also done through expressing further support for Israel, which may manifest itself in the Israelis going at Gaza even harder than before.
There was also a strong argument to say that the U.S. could have gone further with their pressure.
The U.S. would certainly have the leverage, in my assessment, to be able to tell the Israelis, sorry, but you started this. You did not consult us. You told us about this last second.
That is the original consulate strike in Damascus.
You risked a restarting of Iraqi and Syrian militias targeting American troops, putting us in direct danger. And now you got hit back. We helped you to make sure that it didn't become worse than it could have been. But this is it. This is the end of this story. You're not going to do this any further. because we're not going to be able to pay $1.3 billion to continue protecting you when the Iranians are shooting drones that cost no more than $10,000. I see no reason as to why the Biden administration didn't have the leverage to say this.
The US are a key factor in Iran and Israel's recent trade of blows.
Israel knows, and everybody knows, that for Israel, intelligence access, basically superior military capabilities, all those things mean that they can hit Iran, and they can hit Iran hard. But then, given that they are effectively surrounded by Iran's allies, from Hezbollah to the Houthis to other actors, and also given Iran's own capabilities in, let's say, second strike, I mean, to responding to any sort of widespread Israeli attack, they cannot just enter into an actual war without having a full U.S. support, without, making sure that the United States is there, not only for defense, but also for offense. That was what the United States made sure that the Israelis would understand. That's not going to be the case. That contributed a lot, as I said, to the final decision that the Israelis made.
And Marissa Kermer.
I mean, if the Iranians decide they want to escalate further and they're all in for a war with Israel, then that is considered all-out war and, a declaration of war. It's not just tit-for-tatism, right? You will definitely see the United States going in. I mean, the United States has various interests in the region beyond the security of Israel. You have national security interests that are tied to the global economy and thus the U.S. economy, and other political and security interests with military bases across the Middle East that are not just focused on the Persian Gulf, but also are very much part of the U.S. defense posture vis-a-vis other threats coming out of Asia. And that's why the Middle East is integral.
Iran knows that it can't enter a war with Israel without dragging in the U.S. Israel knows that it can't start a war with Iran without U.S. support. And the U.S. does not want to be dragged into a war between Israel and Iran. This does not mean that the risk is zero. There is great risk that conflicts will escalate, even inadvertently. It's a risk that Trita Parsi believes the US have not been taking seriously.
I personally believe that the Biden administration has been far too accepting of the escalation risk. We saw that was a significant increase in the attacks by Iraqi and Syrian militias against US troops and bases. And eventually they succeeded killing three Americans, which then prompted the US to start bombing them. And thankfully that didn't lead to a major further escalation. Now that may very well come to an end because now the Israelis have started to bomb them. So the risk acceptance have been ridiculous in my view. It's endangering US interests and US lives. Hopefully this last episode will have caused the administration to wake up. But I don't think the question has been that they have been asleep. I think the question has been that they have been unwilling to pay the political price they believe they will pay if they actually finally stop treating the Israeli government with kid's gloves. Whatever that cost is, however, it cannot possibly be higher than the cost the president will pay if his inaction leads to the United States getting dragged into a war.
Prior to the exchanges of April, Iran and Israel were often described as being in a shadow war. Hamad Reza Azizi.
Israel would, from time to time, target, as I said, Iranian convoys, some Iranian bases, etc. And there was some room for deniability on both sides, right? Israel wouldn't assume responsibility, wouldn't take responsibility, and Iran would just, turn a blind eye and continue basically doing what they were doing. But by killing the commanders just in broad daylight, and also by shifting the rules to involve all the Iranian personnel and IRGC officers in the country, they had already made it quite difficult for Iran. So this new equation actually is an attempt, I think, to basically, you know, move things back to prior October 7. I'm not sure still to what extent it's going to be successful. And why I'm saying this, because the October 7 changed the threat perception on the Israeli side quite significantly. I mean, if we assume that the logic behind Israel's sort of, for the lack of a better word, restraints in not targeting Iranian commanders was not to ignite a war. Since October 7, they started to see themselves effectively at war with the so-called axis of resistance supported by Iran. So by extension, with Iran itself.
The Iranian and Israeli retaliatory strikes of April brought the conflict into the light. The region came dangerously close to conflict of utterly devastating consequences. The recent strikes have created a new equilibrium between the two sides. Neither side can go back to before April, and the risk remains real. But currently, the lack of desire for a war is balanced. Neither side wants it.
So that was what made the Israelis to abandon the prior rules of engagement. And as we can see, that perception is still there. And even with the end of the war in Gaza, whenever that happens, they have already made it clear that they are going to think of a substantial solution when it comes to Hezbollah, for example, or other parties. So at the best case scenario, we may expect the two sides to just not target each other directly, but the conflict will continue and the risk of escalation will remain there, I think. So that's...
Led by their current governments, Iran and Israel are not going to talk. They will not meet, there won't be summits, and no treaty signing photo ops. But the US and Israel do speak. A lot. And in the past, the US and Iran have spoken. Final words to Trita Parsi.
But at some point, the dialogue between Iran and the United States needs to move beyond the confliction. Because otherwise, we will be stuck in a situation in which we're constantly on the precipices of a conflict. But thanks to that channel, most of the time, hopefully all of the time, it will be avoided. That's not a sufficiently good situation to be in. We should be grateful that it exists. We should be grateful that both sides were adults enough, particularly the Iranians, who otherwise have refused to engage with the United States. The Biden administration has been open to it. The Iranians have not. But it's important that they have, nevertheless, even though they deny it, engaged in those discussions and dialogue with the help of some countries in between who have mediated. But I think we need to move beyond that rather quickly, because we cannot count on getting lucky or that the deconfliction channel will be sufficient every time, particularly if the United States under Biden refuses to force upon the parties a ceasefire. That means that the risk of escalation will continue to be around and likely continue to increase.
This episode of The New Arab Voice was written and produced by me, Hugo Goodridge. Our theme music was by Omar El Phil. The New Arab Voice is taking a short break, but we'll be back with new episodes soon. Until then, you can find all our previous episodes on all major podcast platforms. Our roundup podcast, The New Arab Weekly, will be out with a new episode on Friday. Don't forget to subscribe to get notified for when a new episode drops. You can find a link in the show notes. You can also check out our social media accounts at TNA Podcasts for additional content. And you can email us podcast@newarab.com. You can subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And you can also rate and review, which helps us spread the word. Don't forget to follow The New Arab on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram for all the latest news, analysis and opinion from the region.